Good morning. I'm glad to see some of you are not challenged by snow. Jenny and I spent 4 years in Regina, so after that, everything was uphill. Literally. If you've been to Regina, it's... So no problems going up hills. Thank you to Jillian for reading. She stepped in at the last minute, and thank you for the worship team that stepped in at the last minute as well, too. Looking at all the people on Zoom, it reminds me of the pandemic, when many of us were not here. I think the first Sunday we had no one here, I think TJ preached. The second Sunday I preached, and I stood back there and stared at whoever was on sound. I think it was Henri. An audience of one. So this is a lot better, right? So Jillian read very well the genealogy of Jesus. Most of us would look at those names and go, whoa, you know, that's to be honored because, but this morning we're going to do more than look at their names. But I have a little cartoon. It says, okay, lady, about the food in the basket. We can do this the easy way or the Hitchcock way. And that's, I think, how some people approach the genealogy of Jesus and genealogies in the Old Testament as well. I don't know about you, but many times or in my past and even now, when you read through the Bible in a year or one of those kind of programs, you get to 1 Chronicles and you go, I can pass that, right? How many chapters? How many begats? So that's going to be sort of the second half of the sermon, is going to be looking at the genealogy and what relevance it really has to us today. But first of all, what I want to do is introduce the book of Matthew. As you know, if you're new to New Life, we usually do an Old Testament book and then a New Testament book, and right now we're going to do Matthew. But before that, I probably should say who I am, because I am not Sandeep Jihav. Much as I might want to be, that will not happen. I'm Ted Goshalak, and I'm one of the elders here at New Life. And if you really are a glutton for punishment, you'll be here for the AGM, and then I'll be chairing that. So by then you might say, I don't know about this church, okay? So the Gospel of Matthew is among the most influential books ever written. Now just think about that for a second. When I read that and when I thought about that, that's not what came to mind for me. You think of a lot of other books in the Bible and books in general. Now it's one of four accounts. We have four Gospels. And each one come from that apostolic circle of the original 12 disciples. But in the second and third centuries, Matthew was constantly quoted all the time. And Mark, for example, was almost ignored. Now you think about that. If you've ever been part of a group that wants to disciple young Christians or whatever, or people like that, what happens? You go to the Gospel of Mark. It's short. It's pithy. You wouldn't go to Matthew. It's too long. And it's got that genealogy anyways. Who wants to start with that? But this, I think there's three quotes here that I want to use to start us off. And the first one says, from an Italian scholar by the name of Manlio Simonet, I should get Jillian to pronounce it. It is no exaggeration to state that the faithful who lived between the end of the first and the end of the second centuries came to know the words and deeds of Christ on the basis of this text, and he's referring to Matthew. And secondly, from Howard Clark, who's an American scholar, it's probably not an exaggeration to say that despite an undistinguished Greek style, words from Matthew have been pronounced, prayed, and intoned more often than those of any author we know. And when we hear the Bible says, someone quotes that, we will hear more often from Matthew than from any other book of Scripture. And finally, from Robert Mounts, quote, "Matthew is the gospel that over the years has shaped the life and thought of the church," end of quote. Now, the early church fathers, the first two or three centuries of the church's life, they quoted from this gospel, as I said, more than any other. Mark was almost not there. And some of the reasons were, it was wonderfully complete. It started with a genealogy, which for the Jewish people was very important, and it ended with the death and resurrection of Jesus and the commissioning of the church. It had the whole package. And it had a lot of Jewish stuff in it. A lot of quotations, a lot of innuendos to Jewish practice. And think about it. The early church started with the Jewish people. And then as time came over, by the time Matthew's writing, it's moving beyond that. It's going to the rest of the world. The second point is that the gospel also pointed towards the Gentile Christians. Matthew is dropping hints all along the way. There's what you might call a missionary motif that goes from the very beginning of Matthew in the genealogy itself all the way to the Great Commission in chapter 28. Third, the teachings, the actions, the parables, the miracles, the death and resurrection of Jesus are embodied in a memorably ordered fashion. Matthew has taken time to think this through. And one very strong selling point was that it had a fuller Easter story than Mark. Mark's is very short, and this one is more filled out. And fourthly, the book also gave special prominence and a place to Peter, and especially in relationship to the church in general. And I'll mention in a second, I can mention it now too, that both Matthew and Luke, two of the longest gospels, most of their content comes from Mark. But despite that, and most people feel that Mark got his content because he was not an official, one of the original disciples, he got his content from Peter. They were colleagues in ministry, and Peter told them stories, he wrote them down, and that became the Gospel of Mark. But despite that, there are five incidents in five chapters in Matthew that are nowhere else in the New Testament, and they're all about Peter, what Peter did, and what his role was in the creation of the early church. So this is a very unique gospel. As I mentioned, Matthew also has a very strong interest in what's happening with the church, how it's emerging, how it's organized. In fact, he's the only one of the gospel writers who uses the word ecclesia, which we now use as ecclesial or ecclesiastical, which means church. No one else in the gospels uses that word. So he's concerned not only about the beginning, but he's concerned where they're at now. And as a former librarian, the last one is, it all fit on one papyrus roll. You know, you got to kind of save things. And if it gets too long, then, you know, people are going to forget about it. And something that I never thought of is that in the book of Matthew, there are a number of quotations, a number of sayings and phrases that we use on a probably not a daily basis, but we use quite often, like casting pearls before the swine, salt of the earth, burning the midnight oil, very appropriate to students. I burned a lot of midnight oil. Waiting until 11th hour for procrastinators. Beware of wolves in sheep's clothing. The blind leading the blind. And the left hand not knowing what the right hand is doing. So there's nuggets in our culture that come from directly from the Gospel of Matthew. Now, Matthew's gospel stresses the importance of following and imitating Jesus. That's his bottom line. In fact, if he was here, he would say that's precisely what it means to become a full-fledged disciple. That's what it requires, is to follow and imitate Jesus. The other stuff comes after that. Now, as I mentioned, in this, the community that Matthew is writing to and a part of started out as almost exclusively Jewish. And that's why he's got a lot of Jewish innuendos in his text. But by the time he wrote, it was becoming much more mixed. Gentiles were coming to faith. You see that in the book of Acts. And so he's at the same time as trying to appeal to the Jewish portion of the church, he's also trying to say to the Gentiles, right from the genealogy till now, Jesus had you in mind. It just wasn't for Jews. It was for the world. And that's one of the songs we sang. And Terry mentioned about how the call was to go to all the world. It wasn't just to be our faith. It was to be the world's faith. Now, as I mentioned, Matthew, in his content, uses 90% of Mark. And of that, 50% he quotes word for word. So he's very indebted to Mark, and so is Luke. And that's one of the reasons that the early church, I think, really felt strongly about Matthew as being important. They like, oh, Mark's okay, but Matthew's got what Mark had plus, and he's got it in a very organized manner, and I'll get to that in a second to why that was important. But who wrote the book? We say the title on their Bibles is The Gospel of Matthew, the Book of Matthew. But all the Gospels, when you look at them in the original text, never mention the author's names. They're all technically anonymous. However, by the second century already, people wanted to put names on them. And so already in the second century, early church fathers like Origen, Eusebius, Irenaeus, and Jerome, I'm sure you've read them all. There are better translations coming out. The older ones are hard to read. But all of these men agreed that Matthew, the disciple, was the author of this book. But who is Matthew? Well, we don't know all that much about Matthew. The most we know about him is actually in his own book. And that's in Matthew chapter 9, verses 9 through 12. And then it's also paralleled in Mark and in Luke as well. But in the Mark, what makes things a little bit more interesting is that in Mark and Luke, he's not called Matthew. He's called Levi, the son of Alphaeus. So, is he like Peter? Was he given a new name by Jesus? Or did he have two names? I'm Ted David. Nobody ever calls me David. Or Jay might start doing it. But names were, they had significance in different ways back then. But it's interesting that the name Matthew, which Matthew uses in his own gospel, and the others don't in theirs, in Hebrew it means a gift of God. And today in our sound booth we have Matthew, the gift of God. And we're glad for sound techs, very glad for them. And in Greek, the name Matan, or Matetes, means disciple. So he's probably hinting at something. I'm the disciple, I'm the gift of God, I'm the one who wrote this book. Now, what we do know about Matthew is that he was a tax collector. He set up his shop, so to speak, on the one of the trade route highways near Capernaum. That's up in Galilee. And he would collect taxes for Herod. But immediately when Jesus came to him, come follow me, he got up, had a banquet, invited all his friends. And who were his friends? Other tax collectors. And what were known as sinners. So Matthew's calling and his response were completely out of the ordinary. And they required nothing short of a miraculous turnabout in his life. And just to round off Matthew's stories, because I'm always interested in all these 12 original men who helped found the Christian church. What happened to them? Well, with Matthew, we're not sure. Some people say he died an old man, but most of the disciples were martyred. And there is a tradition that says that later in life he went down to Ethiopia to help the church out there, and he made a comment to the ruler about something that he was doing that was immoral. And then he was killed. So it doesn't sound unlike John the Baptist. So just for a minute, sometimes we skip through, so what was a tax collector? Those of us who work, we all pay taxes, and even as a retired person now, I'm still paying taxes. So that's part of our democracy, right? It's something we just have to do. Well, it was a little different back then. And in fact, there were sort of two types of taxes. The one was what was known as the Jewish temple tax. We'd call it our building fund. It was introduced by Nehemiah, and it was 1/3 of a shekel. Whatever that was, I forgot to look that up. And what it was for the running and maintenance of the temple in Jerusalem. And later, due to inflation, it was increased to 0.5 shekel. So even back then, there was inflation. Now, when Jesus is asked in Matthew 17 whether he paid that tax, what did he do? How did he answer? Well, he told some of his disciples to go catch a fish. And some of them were good at that. He caught a fish, brought it back, he opened the mouth, and he had a coin. It was the right coin to pay the temple tax. The other kind of taxation was Roman taxation. That's what we think of more when we think of the New Testament. The Roman government in Rome had all of their underlings in various parts throughout the empire, and they would say to them, this is your quota. This is how much you need to pay every year to us in Rome. And in the case of where Jesus lived, it was Herod Antipas. Now, Herod didn't want to bother collecting taxes, so he'd get Jewish tax collectors, such as Matthew and another one that we meet in the book of Luke, Zacchaeus. And what he'd say to them, this is your quota, because this is my quota, and that's what we have to send. But beyond that quota, whatever you take is yours. So it was a very lucrative business. And there were three main kinds of taxes. The first was very straightforward. I'm a vineyard owner. I grow grapes, and I have to pay a tenth of that in taxes every year. Just a straight, direct tax. No argument with that. The second one was a head tax. And it never struck me. This is why Joseph and Mary went to Bethlehem. They went to be part of a census. But it's not just a nice census. When you're on the census, you're eligible to pay taxes. And so, that's how the government, a second way, the Romans got money. Now, this is probably the tax that Jesus was talking about in Matthew 22, when they say to him, do you pay taxes to the Romans? Which was a loaded question. And he said, give to Caesar what is Caesar's and to God what is God's. And he sort of turned it back on them. The third kind of tax was the one that involves what we're looking at today more. It's sort of an export-import tax. And it was collected along the roads of Galilee and Judea. And that's where Matthew comes into the story. He would get that contract to collect those taxes. And if I came by with my produce or with what I was trading in goods along that highway, I had to pull in, and there was not a set amount of tax. It was depending on how greedy the tax collector was and how much he could think he could get away with. There was also a lot of bribery, extortion, and money lending. Oh, you can't pay this week? Well, I'll lend the money to you. Next week you'll owe me, and then there would be a higher percent. So people like Matthew and Zacchaeus were very wealthy. But they were considered social pariahs. In fact, the Jewish leadership called them murderers. They were classified with those who killed. And they weren't allowed to go in the synagogues, even though they were Jewish. In fact, the parable of the tax collector and the Pharisee in Luke 18, if you recall, the Pharisee stands there and says, I'm glad to God for all the good things I do and all the money I give away. And standing over here is a tax collector who says, I'm a sinner. And he's standing far away. And the reason he's standing far away is because he's not allowed to go in. He knows who he is. By choosing to become a tax collector, he knows what the cost of that is. He might be wealthy, but he's shunned. And that's who Matthew was. So when was this book written? Well, probably around 80 AD. So if Jesus died 30, 33 AD, this is about 50 years after Jesus was crucified and resurrected. Mark had been written about 10 years earlier. So Mark is there. It's probably being disseminated. And you recall, everything would have to be written by hand. They didn't have internet, surprisingly. They didn't have printing. In fact, a while after this, copies of Matthew started coming out in a codex, a book form, but at this point they would all come out as scrolls. So they had to be copied. And where was it written? Well, most people agree it was probably in Antioch. And Antioch was the third largest city in the Roman Empire. And it also happened to have a large Jewish population. And it's another factor that helped with Matthew and with the dissemination of the faith was that their synagogues were very welcoming to proselytized people and God-fearers. And we've heard of those people when we've done various books of Paul, is that these are people who are interested in the Jewish faith and they can come and watch. And in some cases, they become Jews. Also, the way the culture of that city, because it was such a large city, it was a good ideal place for Jewish and Christian ideals to appeal to the people, because the main language there would have been Greek. It wouldn't have been Hebrew or Aramaic. But all those things, why was it written? If there's this great little short book of Mark, why would you want to write something bigger? Well, the Gospel of Matthew served as an evangelist. It had really three reasons. First of all, it served an evangelistic tool to Jews. You had come to faith, but you wanted to talk to your neighbor about it. Here was a document that you could use. Because they were all waiting for the Messiah. And those Jews who had come to faith said, here he is. And here's what you can know about him. It also served as an apologetic tool for Jewish Christians. Once they had come to faith, they could use it sort of to reach out to others as well, almost the same as the first. And finally, it was written to Gentiles because they would have no concept at all about the history of Israel. They wouldn't know all about it. What's a Messiah? So they have to, in a sense, get the backstory, and then they get where the church is at now and why Jesus is Lord and why he is the one that you should follow. Matthew's gospel was really written to act like a teaching tool. And some of that we don't see because we're not Jews. Because it was really written, in a sense, for teachers to disseminate the Christian faith in an organized way. And the other point that I always forget is that a large percent of those people could not read. So you had to have something in writing that those who were your disciples, those who were your teachers in your local Christian congregation, could have something to stand up and read and use as a tool to teach you about various aspects of the Christian faith. And Matthew's organized like that. And another interesting thing, when you think of the Apostle Paul and how he would write a letter to the Philippians, he'd write a letter to the Ephesians, but he wasn't in Ephesus and he wasn't in Philippi. He'd been there and maybe in some cases started the church, but he'd gone. He was somewhere else because he was always moving. These gospel writers, and certainly including Matthew, compiled gospel stories for the churches in which they were active participants. They were part of that church. So, you can imagine one Sunday, Matthew stands up and he starts reading the genealogy of Jesus, the Son of God. And they're going, huh, never heard that before. He's compiling his gospel while he's part of a live and active church. It's not in some kind of an abstract, this is dealing with each of you as followers of Jesus and what it means to be that and how it's taken place in the past and how it's moving on now and what you need to do to become a deeper and deeper follower of Jesus. Now, this is a little long section, but I'm going to try and make it short because sometimes we so focus on the, if you will, the religious part of the text, that we forget other parts that are just as important. And one of these is the background of where these people lived, where Matthew wrote, where the church began. So I want to look very quickly at the geographical and political world of first century Palestine. Because it's often assumed that, hey, we're all Jews. We're all the same. No. The one thing they would be the same on is how much they hated the Romans. They had a common enemy. But in the case of Galilee, if you can see on the map, the top is, let's back it up, Matthew, or Michael. Back to the map, if you could. You have Galilee at the top, Samaria in the middle, and Judea in the bottom. And way at the top of the Sea of Galilee is Capernaum, where Matthew was. And way down at the bottom is Bethlehem and Jerusalem. So the road would go right through Samaria that Matthew was sitting on, collecting taxes. So you have, in a sense, three provinces. And Galilee was on the top. But in the first century, in fact, all the way back to Solomon, it was a distinct province with its own history, its own political status, and its own culture. Sure, they were Jews, but as we'll hear, they weren't always seen the same. What Judea as a province had is they had the city of Jerusalem. That was the holy city, and everybody had to come there to do their religious rites. That also probably made them feel a little bit special. Now, what was the situation in Galilee like in the first century? Well, racially, it was much more mixed in ethnicity than was Judea. And as we see, geographically, it was separated. It was away, and in between was a non-Jewish province of Samaria. And we hear that in various stories where Jesus stops at the well and talks to the Samaritan woman. Well, he's traveling. He's going back and forth. And politically, Galilee had had a separate administration from Judea all its history. Now, at the time of Jesus, it was under a fellow who called himself a native Herodian prince. He really wasn't, but he pretended he was. While Judea and Samaria, since AD 6, had been under the direct rule of the Roman prefect, So there's two different political, they're both Roman, but they act somewhat differently. And economically, Galilee actually was much better off. They had the Sea of Galilee, a strong fishing industry. They had a lot of farming, agriculture. Whereas Judea was all hills and mountains. So they struggled a lot more economically, which ticked them off. Why do those Galileans up there, they have all this wealth, and, you know, we're the real true Jewish people, and we have to suffer, economically at least. Culturally, they despised the Galileans. The Judeans thought what we today would call country cousins. You know, I grew up in Chilliwack, which is down the valley here. I had cousins who lived in Rosedale. Rosedale, that's where all the farmers live, you know? And that's sort of the way they would think about them. They weren't as sophisticated. And they also seemed to be more open to Hellenistic influence outside of Judaism. And this is the one that I think is interesting. Linguistically, the Galileans spoke a very distinct form of Aramaic, what the Jewish people in Judea would call slovenly consonants. And they were often the butt of Jewish jokes, sort of like, and I hope we don't do this, but talk about people from Newfoundland or other kind of places like that, which have different kinds of accents to ours and obviously are not quite as educated and sophisticated as us. I hope there's no Newfoundland people here. Yeah. I love them. Yeah. Oh, you? Oh, you're a great guy. Yeah. I would never make fun of your accent. Now, that's all very interesting, but it hits the ground when you think of Jesus. Where is Jesus from? Galilee. He's from the city of Nazareth. And for him to gain acceptance as the Messiah, coming from that northern province, and then wanting to go to Jerusalem and say, "Here I am, your Messiah." Even the enthusiasm of the people and the crowds in Galilee probably wasn't exactly a winning proposition for the people down south. Oh yeah, one of them. We don't need him. And it even comes into the Gospels, because in John 1, when one of the newly minted disciples comes to Nathanael and says, "Come, we've found this fellow. He's the Messiah. He's Jesus of Nazareth." And what does, I think we all probably know what Nathanael says. Can anything good come from Nazareth? Can anything good come from Rosedale? You know, he's not from Jerusalem. He's not from our part of the world. So that's another factor even that I'd be quite honest, I never really thought of in Jesus gaining acceptance. And when he did finally go to Jerusalem, it's only Matthew of all the gospel writers who comments on the reaction of the crowds and of the people of the city. Two different reactions. And this is, I'll quote this from Matthew 21. "When he, Jesus, entered Jerusalem, the whole city was in turmoil. 'Who is this?' the crowds were saying." Or, I mean, we're asking, "Who is this?" These are the local people, the Jerusalem people.